Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence I've admired and been proud to be partnered with for a long time is our first guest. He is Dr. J. Michael Waller. He is a renowned professor of international relations and political warfare. He is a man who has been training our military personnel in some of these black arts for some time. He is also, I'm proud to say, the Vice President for Government Affairs at the Center for Security Policy. And always a welcome guest here. Michael, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Frank.
Well, I wanted to quickly touch base with you, Michael, about this flashpoint in the Black Sea, where the Russian Navy shot at and Air Force, I guess, and commandeered three Ukrainian vessels. What can you tell us about the run-up to this and what might come of it?
Well, it's more of Russia asserting its dominance and control over Crimea, having received weak response from the West, apart from sanctions and apart from some token support from Ukraine. So it's to be expected. It's controlling the Sea of Azov is a very small area right next to Crimea, very small sea with a very narrow opening. It's a strait that's connected by a bridge. So the Russians blocked off that bridge to keep Ukraine out and then fired on and rammed some Ukrainian warships and Coast Guard ships in the area.
And this is going to be a topic of conversation in the course of the day today at NATO, which is in considerable high dudgeon about it. Is this evidence, as you see it, Michael, of an increasing assertiveness by the Russians? We'll be talking a little later in the program with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry about what they're doing with their nuclear forces, what they're doing with their military exercises, and so on. Are we up to the challenge that is being posed by Putin at the moment? And do you think this is likely to feature in the conversations he's expected to have on the margins of the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires later this week?
I'm sure it will be of concern. I don't think NATO is in very good shape to do much about it because, of course, Germany is intent on integrating the European Union with Russia through the Nord Stream pipeline, which is a Russian-controlled gas pipeline that will supply much of Central Europe through Germany with gas, and that will keep hard currency being pumped into the Kremlin and make Western Europe dependent on Russian gas. So I don't see how NATO can really do a whole lot with this purposeful dependency on Moscow through allies like Germany. There are other things in play as well. I was on the phone over the weekend with people in Ukraine to get a grip on this situation, and the president of Ukraine may declare martial law over the entire country and start conscripting young men to go fight on the Russian front. But also in Belarus, which is a dictatorship right between Ukraine and NATO countries like Poland and the Baltic states, they're concerned that they might be reabsorbed by Russia. So you may see some Russian moves to consolidate control over what it calls its own rightful space right up against the NATO border.
The so-called near abroad, I think, is how they've called it over the years. And Michael, this, I thought where you were going to go with that comment about what the Germans are up to, along with the French as well, is this idea of a EU army, a counterpoint or really rival, I think it's fair to say, to NATO. There's a lot of talk about putting money into that army. It would clearly, it seems to me, come at the expense of NATO at a minimum. How does that fit into this larger sort of strategic play to wean Europe from its past historical strategic relationship with the United States and endear itself to the Russians.
It's an EU effort to undermine the alliance and to push the United States out of Europe. So while on the one hand, the EU is accusing the United States of being anti-NATO, anti-alliance, and denouncing our support for sovereignty of these countries in Europe, the EU itself is trying to get its own sovereignty as a super state and to build its own army with its own command and control that would parallel that of NATO and ultimately eclipse that of NATO, and keep the United States influence at a minimum in Europe. I think it's a Russian-backed project because the critics are so supporters of the EU army are so quick to denounce people like us as Russian trolls and Russian agents because we oppose this force. When in reality, it's something that Putin wants. Putin is going to be providing it with the fuel, and that EU is going to be providing Putin with the cash. So you can see where this is headed.
Yeah. Symbiotic relationship, very much at the expense of, I would argue, the free world's interests, certainly those of the United States. Which brings me to another question, Michael. There has been talk of having an ex-KGB officer, that is to say, figure in the Russian intelligence services, heading up Interpol, the so-called international police force. Talk about how crazy an idea that would be, and is it likely to come to pass?
Well, Interpol has been a mess. It's a really old international police organization. It's been very useful, but gangster regimes like Russia and China have used it to put out red notices or arrest warrants for critics who have exiled themselves abroad, and they really abuse the system. The previous head of Interpol was from communist China. He returned as Interpol chief to China, and then he disappeared. And Interpol didn't say too much about it. Now they want to replace him. A lot of people wanted to replace him with a Putin officer. But that was recently defeated in its first stage anyway, to get a non-Russian person in there who the U.S. backed. So the Trump administration really rallied hard to make sure that the Russians did not take control of Interpol.
So this is off the table at the moment, as you understand it. I saw a notice about the Brits saying they wouldn't be part of Interpol if it went forward, but I hadn't heard that this cup has passed from our lip.
Yeah, apparently it has. Late last week, there was a vote, and by about a two-thirds margin, they voted against the Russians.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah, so it was really good diplomatic work on the U.S. and British sides.
Yeah, well, and, you know, to the credit of the Trump administration, I think it's come around to the view that while it would prefer to have improved relations with Russia, it's not bloody likely under present circumstances, as the Russians conduct themselves in this fashion, and they're standing up to them. Michael Waller, thank you so much for what you do at the Center for Security Policy, among other places, and I look for an important new decision brief that Michael Waller has helped us with on the need to declassify Presidential Study Directive 11, Barack Obama's blueprint for embracing and empowering the Muslim Brotherhood. That will be coming up shortly. Michael, thank you. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry about Vostok 18 and the meager NATO response right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined by Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He is one of the country's preeminent experts on, well, a whole host of national security issues, but particularly those involving the nuclear threats against our nation. And he has been singularly impactful in his long and storied career, starting with his time as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, as his member on the professional staff of the House Armed Services Committee, his long service on the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission and the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission. As a man who understands some of the most threatening problems that we currently face with respect to the vulnerability of our infrastructure. And we'll be talking with him a little bit about that momentarily. But first, I did want to commend to you all his many superb books, including, I believe most recently, Blackout Wars, State Initiatives to Achieve Preparedness Against an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe. Dr. Pry, it is great to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Frank, thanks so much for having me.
Well, where to begin, Peter? I thought perhaps by picking up on some of the conversations I just had with Dr. Michael Waller about the challenge that we're seeing emanating from Vladimir Putin's Russia in that context to the Ukraine. But you've been writing for some time about what the Russians are up to that is a threat to this country as well, their strategic force modernization program, their Vostok 18 exercises we've talked about at length in the past on this program. I did want to get your thoughts about a relatively modest exercise called Trident Juncture 18 that NATO forces engaged in recently, bearding the lion a bit, shall we say, or the bear, as the case may be. Talk a little bit about it and some of the concerns you've expressed about what the Russians did in response.
Sure. Trident Juncture 18, compared to the exercises we used to conduct in the Cold War, was indeed a modest exercise. It involved 50,000 troops, 250 aircraft, about 60 ships, and mobilized some 10,000 vehicles. That doesn't sound small, but compared to NATO or Cold War era exercises, they were much bigger than that. And NATO itself didn't characterize this. The press characterized this as a huge and massive exercise because compared to the exercises NATO normally conducts these days, it was huge. It was the biggest exercise NATO has conducted in some time. But it was really dwarfed by Vostok 18 and by exercises that Russia carries out routinely every year. They haven't reduced the size of their Cold War era exercises. But the thing that was, and indeed, Trident Juncture 18 was also advertised as a response to Vostok 18. It was supposed to show that the Europeans are committed and able to mobilize the forces to defend themselves against something like a Vostok 18. But the thing is, it didn't. 50,000 troops compared to the 300,000 troops that were mobilized by the Russians, for example. 10,000 vehicles compared to the 36,000 vehicles and tanks mobilized by the Russians. The Russians mobilized, four times as many aircraft. And this is by not only in the 30 NATO member states, but also it included Sweden, that actually for the first time broke its official neutral status to participate in the exercise. Because the exercise was focused on protecting NATO's northern flank. Russia has been increasingly aggressive everywhere, but particularly in rattling the saber and actually taking concrete actions to occupy islands and areas in the Arctic, laying claim to the Arctic seabed, which is, wealth of oil resources.
Yeah, and threatening the Baltic states and otherwise, projecting power into the North Sea and so on. This is a challenge that we're facing that I'm so appreciative of you calling them out, and not least, apparently, some jamming that they did of our global positioning satellite systems, which are known to be susceptible to that sort of thing and can be very, very catastrophically decisive in interfering with our military operations if GPS is not available. But Peter, I wanted to switch gears if I could quickly. We're very much concerned about a nuclear threat from another quarter. We've been told that it is being mitigated by the efforts President Trump is making to denuclearize North Korea. But there's some recent evidence that is very much aligned with what you've been warning of for some time about North Korea's intentions to use electromagnetic pulse or EMP in attacks against us. Discuss that if you would.
Sure. There was a recently translated it's described as a propaganda booklet that is being circulated to North Korean workers and farmers. And in this booklet, it describes the effects of a nuclear EMP attack and the effects it can have on electronic systems. This booklet is not intended to be discovered by the West, even though some analysts interpret it as a signal from North Korea, that they don't intend to give up their nuclear weapons. I don't go that far with it. I think actually the implications are more ominous. What they're doing is educating their workers and their farmers about the kinds of effects that you could expect if a nuclear EMP attack were to happen, so that they could be prepared, to do simple things. For example, you can shut off electronic machinery, and it will significantly increase the likelihood that it would survive. One of the scenarios that we've actually seen the North Koreans exercise is doing a high-altitude fusing of a medium-range missile over their own country. It would create an EMP field that would cover North Korea, but South Korea as well. And this was done in the context of an exercise where they were simulating a South Korean and U.S. invasion of North Korea. We've also seen them undertake actions that involve, EMP attacks on South Korea directly. If they were to attack South Korea with an EMP, the field would extend into North Korea. Now, knowing when the attack is made, they would be able to protect themselves against it by turning off critical systems. And they're not as vulnerable to EMP as we and the Japanese are, because their electronic systems are much older and based on technologies that are literally like a million times less vulnerable to EMP effects.
And on top of that, there are just that many fewer of them in North Korea.
That's right. That's right. But I would point out that the North Koreans are actually doing more through this pamphlet than the Department of Homeland Security in the United States is, to prepare our workers and farmers and people in the industries to safeguard against an EMP event.
Well, and this brings me to our last question, Peter Pry. You have been involved, as I've mentioned, from the inception of the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission, an absolutely indispensable effort by Congress to pull together the best scientists in the country, most deeply knowledgeable professionals like yourself, to explore and ascertain the magnitude of our vulnerability to precisely the sort of attack that the North Koreans were discussing with their people in this manifesto. But what has happened to the Electromagnetic Pulse Commission, the EMP Threat Commission, in the past few years is, I think, a national scandal. And one of the things that I wanted to invite you to come on to talk about today, briefly at least for the moment, is insights into what happened to the EMP Commission at the hands of something called the Washington Headquarters Services organization within the Department of Defense, now exposed as a, swamp headquarters, perhaps you might call it, by a suit that Judicial Watch has brought on behalf of Adam Lovinger, a whistleblower who we both know and I think admire. Talk us through this quickly, if you would, Peter Pry. What happened to the EMP Commission, and what's the effect of it?
Well, Washington Headquarters Services is supposed to provide support to congressional commissions like the EMP Commission. It's supposed to find ways to provide us with our budget. Money had actually been specifically appropriated to the Congressional EMP Commission, from Congress, and they're supposed to be able to set up contracts to make that money available. They're supposed to make available security clearances so the commissioners can see and the staff can see classified information, and provide office space and things of that sort so that the Commission Act can actually work. And basically, the Washington Headquarters Services. And don't forget, when the EMP Commission was reestablished in 2015, it was still the Obama administration. And so for our first year, it was still the Obama administration. And the Washington Headquarters Services, I believe, at the behest of the Obama administration, that was basically opposed to the EMP Commission and didn't want to know anything about EMP and didn't want the public to know, that these guys had their marching orders to sabotage us, which is what they did. They held up our money for a whole year. They held up clearances for a year. They were very slow in providing office space, and the office space that was so inconvenient and difficult for us to use, the commission basically rarely ended up using it when we eventually did get it. The bottom line is they managed to take, we had an 18-month lifespan when the EMP Commission was reestablished from 2016 into 2017. We had 18 months to do our work, and they basically held us up for a whole year, held us up for a whole year. So we had to do 18 months of work in 6 months. And they tried to, they objected when commissioners and staff worked for free, worked pro bono, and said, well, we're just not waiting for you guys. You know, we'll have our meetings in, elsewhere, and we're going to start working and doing what we can. And they objected to that and tried to stop us, basically, from working for free for the American people.
Unbelievable. I just wanted to say personally, thank you for all that you have done, Peter, personally, as well as part of this important team. You are, as I say, a national treasure, and we prize our opportunity to speak with you. In the meantime, keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we are joined by an old friend and colleague, Michael Cutler. He is a career veteran of the Immigration and Naturalization Services, in which he served for some 30 years, including doing various line functions, inspections at JFK Airport, as well as working on interagency bases on criminal investigations in New York City with the Intelligence Division of the Drug Enforcement Agency and more. Who better to talk to about what is going on the border at the moment than our friend Michael? Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back.
Frank, always a privilege to join you. Thank you for the great work you do in getting that important information out there to your audience.
Well, and thank you for yours as well. It's always a delight to catch up with you at Front Page and elsewhere, but particularly on the program. And Michael, especially with this latest drama at the border, just yesterday there were what I think can only be described as attacks on our Border Patrol by some of these so-called caravanners. Who are these people, and why are they acting in this fashion as opposed to being the genteel, polite asylum seekers that we were assured would be coming eventually, but no time in the near future?
Yeah, well, great question. Who are they? And we don't know. And what we don't know can get us hurt quite badly. Look, the point of the matter is, first, let's make a couple of quick points. First of all, this caravan is a long time in the making. I wrote about that for Front Page magazine. Both political parties bear responsibility. They don't want secure borders. They didn't want to build the border wall. That is to say, both parties did not fund the wall. The Republicans controlled both houses of Congress. They had the Republican president in the White House who wanted the wall built, no wall. We never hire enough ICE agents. So if you run the border, if you enter the United States, if you are released under the insane catch and release concept, there's no one to look for you if you fail to show for hearings. So well over 90% fail to show for hearings. There's no consequences. So that's the backdrop. The other backdrop, of course, has to be the trial of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman in the Eastern District of New York, right here in Brooklyn, for drug trafficking, moving allegedly over 200 tons of cocaine across that border, meth, heroin, other drugs, violence and crime, the whole nine yards right here in New York City. That being the cause, because, again, we have a wide open border, very little interior enforcement of the immigration laws and sanctuary policies. So aspiring illegal aliens know that as the growing number of sanctuary cities, so-called, grow, and even sanctuary states, they can count on being able to hide in plain sight and go about whatever it is they want, whether it's working illegally, sending money home, which hurts the U.S. economy, which depresses wages for American workers and often, all too often, displaces American workers, to the potential for more criminals, more drug dealers. And I have to read something to you, because this is very important for your audience to understand. There was a hearing, and one of many on this topic, but there was a hearing held on April 17th of this year by the House Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. And one of the witnesses, an expert, who was not refuted by any of the other witnesses, in fact, they all agreed with him, even the Democrat witness, his name, Dr. Emmanuel Ottolenghi of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, There's two paragraphs. The second one, extremely important. The first one sets the stage for the second. Here we go. In recent years, Hezbollah's Latin American networks have also increasingly cooperated with violent drug cartels and criminal syndicates, often with the assistance of local corrupt political elites. Cooperation includes laundering of drug money, arranging multi-ton shipments of cocaine to the United States and Europe, and directly distributing and selling illicit substances to distant markets. Proceeds from these activities finance Hezbollah's arms procurement, its activities overseas, its hold on Lebanon's political system, and its efforts both in Lebanon and overseas to keep the Shia community loyal to its causes and complicit in its endeavors. And this, by the way, folks, happening in Latin America, not in the Middle East, because here comes the second paragraph. This toxic crime-terror nexus is fueling both the rising threat of global jihadism and the collapse of law and order across Latin America that is helping to drive drugs and people northward into the United States. It is sustaining Hezbollah's growing financial needs. It is helping Iran and Hezbollah consolidate a local constituency in multiple countries across Latin America. It is thus facilitating their efforts to build safe havens for terrorists in a continent-wide terror infrastructure that they could use to strike U.S. targets. Now, consider the so-called relationship we now have with Iran, because that terrible nuclear deal that Obama arranged with all the billions of dollars, it looked like a movie and a bad drug deal. That's what's going on with Iran, threatening, in fact, to use their missiles to hit our aircraft carriers and other ships and so forth. So here we are. That's the backdrop. How could we allow this to happen, knowing that there may well be terrorists embedded in that mob?
What you've described is a national security, as well as homeland security, disaster. You've got an open border. You've got incentives to people to come here through various magnets, sanctuary cities and the like. And you've got people who are determined to bring dangerous, toxic things into our country, whether it's drugs or whether it's, terrorism. Michael, I want you to talk a little bit about the fact the president of the United States is trying to close this border down. He's trying to get a wall in place. He's trying to keep these caravan types from breaking in. And he has tried to address one of these magnets, this idea that they can get asylum if they can just get a toe into the United States, by proclamation. And he's had a federal judge say, no, you can't do that. So talk us through what the president's options are and what these federal judges are doing to our national and homeland security.
Look, the lunacy is that the president has absolute authority. I've written about this extensively for Front Page Magazine, also The Social Contract. In point of fact, the president has the authority to control the entry of aliens into the United States. In fact, this is the section of law, Title 8, United States Code section. It's Title 8, Section 1182, small f in parenthesis. Whenever the president finds that the entry of any aliens or of any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, that's an awfully low bar, detrimental to the interests, he may, by proclamation, which he issued, and for such period as he deems necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or of any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions that he may deem to be appropriate. So when the judge says that the president is violating the law, that, Your Honor, is a lie, and you know it. And if you want to talk about the constitutionality, look at Article 4, Section 4, where in the states are to be protected from invasion and domestic violence. I think we have all the elements there. What is happening is a disaster, and it's being engineered for political gain, even at the risk to many innocent lives and to national security. How much clearer could I make it?
Yeah, I think that's very succinctly put and unfortunately entirely demonstrably true. So the president has put down this proclamation pursuant to law. This federal judge has said that's illegal, you can't do it. Where does this leave matters at the moment? Is the president, in effect, going to be violating this federal judge's ruling, or is there going to be a rapid appeal of this judge's ruling so that the president can have the authority that he needs, unmistakably.
I hope he gets a rapid appeal before the Supreme Court. I hope some sanity prevails. But, you know, I would love judges to face consequences when they do things that are as crazy as this. If a police officer or a federal agent uses deadly force improperly, they certainly pay a price. They go to jail, they lose their jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is leaving America open to an invasion. We're living in a perilous era. We're being inundated by narcotics, as I mentioned, the record number of deaths because of drugs pouring across the border. Gang violence is at an all-time high. And we face the threat of terrorism from Iran and other countries. How in the world could the judge, in essence, order America's shields down under such circumstances? And by the way, for the Democrats who have called immigration agents thugs, like the idiot governor of New York State, Andy Cuomo, who are the thugs, Andy? Grow up and understand that politics isn't everything. You swore an oath to defend the Constitution of New York State and the federal Constitution and to protect the people of the state of New York. The lunacy being foisted on Americans by politicians, people like Nancy Pelosi, who stands with MS-13 over the president of the United States. You are the folks who've let out, who've put down the welcome mat, and now your company is coming. I hope that you're happy. This is how this sort of thing got initiated. When you vilify immigration law enforcement, and by the way, immigration agents provide the second largest contingent of law enforcement officers to the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and for good reason. Every foreign terrorist who enters America one way or the other is violating our immigration laws.
What you've described so well, of course, is a problem in which politics are trumping, if I can use that expression, common sense, let alone basic survival instincts. And it's not just the name calling, of course, that primarily Democrats have engaged in. They are talking about dismantling one of those elements of our homeland security and our border protection, the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency. This is insanity. And unfortunately, we have the lunatics running the asylum coming up in January. If these people are going to begin moving on this agenda, I trust nothing will come of it. But still, it has to be terribly demoralizing to the men and women who are in those frontline positions and putting ourselves at great risk because their eyes are off the ball. Michael, you are part of our first lines of defense. I appreciate your past service to our country as well as that you're rendering these days as host of the Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk Radio. Also, check out his terrific writings, among other places, at Front Page Magazine. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon, sir. In the meantime, keep up that great work.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent experts on matters involving Asia and our vital interests there. He is the author of two terrific books, related subjects, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. You can find his writings weekly in places like The Daily Beast and The National Interest. And we're always privileged, as I say, to have him with us each week as well. Gordon, thank you for joining us again. Come on back.
Well, thank you so much, Frank.
I wanted to start, we were talking earlier in the program with Michael Waller about an expected conversation between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump on the margins of the G20 meeting. Another widely expected event is a similar meeting between the President of the United States and the President of China, Xi Jinping. What do you expect will come of the latter?
President Trump and Xi Jinping will meet probably for dinner on Saturday at right after the end of the G20. And they're supposed to talk about trade. There are so many predictions about what will happen. Many people would like to see a deal. The market certainly would. I don't know if that will actually occur. I think it's actually a bad thing if there's a deal. We've had so many arrangements, agreements, whatever, with China. China's dishonored them all. And while China, while we talk with China, while you know, we try to enforce agreements, they continue to take U.S. intellectual property to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars a year. So they talk, we bleed. And so I hope that we come out of this with renewed vigor on the part of the administration to impose costs on China.
I do, too. And that seems to be the president's strategic vision here. We'll see whether there's succumbing to the temptation to do otherwise, though, and look forward to your report on that, Gordon. Speaking of an important development, Louis Freeh, the former director of the FBI, Gordon, has come out and said it, and we need to retaliate in kind against what the Chinese are doing with their cyber attacks on our country and our businesses. Your thoughts on the Freeh suggestion here?
The former FBI director said that the only thing that will work will be retaliatory cyber attacks. I actually don't think that that's correct. I think that if we impose crushing economic sanctions, the Chinese will stop. So far, no president has done that yet. So I think that plan B are the retaliatory cyber attacks. I don't like them in the sense that we're going to reveal how good we are, because if we do this, they've got to be those attacks have got to be crippling, as we have seen. So we've got to use our best technology. I would only like to see that used when we actually need to in the event of a war. But you know, I think that the important thing here, Frank, is that Louis Freeh has started an important national conversation. We need to have this, and it needs to be something that the administration is willing to conduct, because Chinese cyber attacks right now are crippling not only our defense establishment, but also our commercial enterprises. So this is a broad-based attack on the U.S. We need to respond. We need to win. And however we do it, I think we're going to have that conversation, because the American people need to be on board.
Yeah, I agree, Gordon. And it's not just crippling our defense sector and other commercial interests. It's actually benefiting the Chinese dramatically, as you say, to the tune, we're told, of something on the order of $500 billion a year of stolen intellectual property that they're exploiting to our detriment as well. Let me ask you, Gordon, about another element of what's going on with the Chinese at the moment. There is, as we've been discussing, a degree of, well, I think on his most dramatic day, George Orwell couldn't have comprehended what is now emerging in terms of the social credit scoring, as they say, that the Chinese are engaged in. We're told that they intend to have this so-called green channel mechanism for rewarding people with good social credit scores, fully in place and operationalized by the end of 2020. Can you just give us a sort of sense of what that means, both within China and to the extent they export it to other places besides, for freedom more generally?
Beijing plans to put in place a nationwide, as you say, credit scoring system, but this is going to be personal data as well as credit data. So all aspects of a person's life, from jaywalking to political statements, to whether they pay their bills on time, whether they go to you know, rallies or whatever, all of this will be put in and there will be a score. Now, this is being done on a local basis. In certain Chinese municipalities. Some places it's completely failed where it's been heavy-handed. Other places it's actually gotten some sort of acceptance from people because people stop jaywalking, for instance, and that's considered to be a good thing. What the Communist Party plans to do, though, is to knit together all of these local systems into one big nationwide one. This is going to be a challenge from a technological point of view. They've been putting back the date for this. So it was supposed to be in place in 2020. Now they're putting it back to 2021. This is Orwellian. This will give the state of obviously much more control, because what they've been doing already, even in the absence of a nationwide system, is been denying people the access to getting on flights, for instance, if their score is too low.
The implications of this for control and for rewarding behavior and penalizing behavior are almost unimaginable, and I think ought to be of grave concern, as I say, in part because of what it will mean for the people of China, but also the export model of this and what it will mean for people in many, many reaches beyond, presumably, notably through this Belt and Road Initiative operation of the Chinese. Hey, Gordon, lastly and very quickly, there's a report out today that a Chinese scientist has achieved the feat of using a technology known as CRISPR to create DNA that is now in the form of two live twin girls in southern China. Any thoughts on the implications of that for China and the world beyond?
Yeah, there have been gene editing, and these twins are supposedly resistant to HIV, which you normally think would be a good thing. But the point is that once we start messing with our DNA in this fashion, all sorts of unintended consequences will certainly happen. You know, the Chinese, we could do this if we wanted to. We don't because of ethics. And what China is going to do is create a race to the bottom, because people will inadvisedly want to have their kids gene edited. This is a awful development, and we can only ascribe it to an authoritarian, now totalitarian political system that is determined to do whatever it can, not whatever it should.
Well, and I guess this is where I wanted just to take it, is it possible that a government that is intent on having this kind of control, that is putting into place the instruments of it, would take the CRISPR technology and try to begin generating on a mass scale, you know, the kinds of, let's say, military capable men who would be optimized for, you know, intelligence and for strength and for the ruthlessness of character that would make them into an even more dangerous adversary in the future. Is that a possibility as well?
I think it's a probability on the part of the Chinese. This is Third Reich stuff. There are good reasons why we don't do this. Because although a country can get a temporary advantage, the implications for humankind really are just the worst. You know, hopefully the People's Republic will fail before they can actually put this into place. But this is where China's going, Frank.
It seems to me, in light of all of that, it ought to be our purpose to make sure it fails, not just hope for the best in this regard. But Gordon, that's a topic for another day. We appreciate so much your time on this one, and I hope that you'll come back to us again next week, and that the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.